Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate media have been declaring organized labor moribund and sometimes abetting efforts to kill it for many years now. But more than 30,000 public school teachers in Los Angeles on strike with overwhelming community support would suggest that you ought not believe everything you read. We'll hear about the L.A. teacher strike and competing visions for public education from Kent Wong, director of the UCLA Labor Center and vice president of the California Federation of Teachers. Also on the show, the Trump White House is trying to bring that whole breaking with democratic norms thing to the issue of Medicaid. Congress disapproved of plans to shrink the program that helps millions of children, elderly, and people with disabilities and serious health conditions. So the Trump administration reportedly wants to push through cuts by executive action. Whether or not that can happen, it's a clear sign that Medicaid remains a target. And we'll talk about what that means with Rebecca Vallis, vice president of the Poverty to Prosperity program at the Center for American Progress and host of the podcast Off Kilter. That's coming up, but first, a very quick look back at recent press. A president facing a major scandal, just as the highest profile trial is about to begin, pardons the indicted or convicted officials around him to effectively stop an investigation that's closing in on his own illegal conduct. Donald Trump soon? Well, we'll see. But this describes what President George H.W. Bush actually did in 1992. As Fair Associate Sam Husseini reminds on Fair.org, the Iran-Contra scandal revealed that the Reagan-Bush White House had secretly sold missiles to Iran in exchange for hostages held in Lebanon, using the proceeds to fund right-wing forces fighting the leftist Nicaraguan government in violation of U.S. law. On Christmas Eve, 1992, just as the indicted former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger was about to face trial, Bush pardoned him and five others, including former Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams and former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane. The Attorney General for Bush, who approved the pardons, William Barr, now being nominated for the same position by Trump. So is this background relevant? The Associated Press didn't seem to think so. The wire service framed its January 14th report on Barr, carried by thousands of outlets, as a stark contrast between the gentlemanly Bush and the twice-divorced Trump, and made no mention of the Iran-Contra pardons. The misleading comparison was compounded by AP describing Trump as breaking with the practice of shielding law enforcement from political influence, as if William Barr didn't have direct experience in exactly that. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. As we record on January 16th, the strike by more than 30,000 Los Angeles teachers is entering its third day. The decision to go on strike is never a whimsical one. The union, United Teachers of Los Angeles, hasn't had a strike in nearly 30 years. Coverage appears to be deepening as the labor action continues, but corporate media's initial response consisted of headlines like the New York Times' Los Angeles Teachers Strike, disrupting classes for 500,000 students, and CNN's The Los Angeles Teachers Strike may already have cost millions, and it's only day two. The sort of old-school owners offer, unions demand language that has marked media treatment of labor for decades. Here to help us see what's behind this momentous collective action by L.A. educators is Kent Wong, director of the UCLA Labor Center and vice president currently of the California Federation of Teachers. He joins us by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome to Counterspin, Kent Wong.
Thanks very much.
Well, strikes generally involve multiple issues of various scales, but they have to be enough taken together to push people to do something that involves tremendous uncertainty and that, you know, some media suggestions to the contrary, organizers are never eager to do. What should we understand about what has motivated some 98% of the union to authorize this strike?
What is remarkable about the Los Angeles teacher strike is that the main issue is not wages. The fact that 98% of the teachers of Los Angeles voted to authorize this strike reflects a deep discontent in the direction of public education here in Los Angeles, but indeed throughout the country. California public schools used to be number one in per pupil funding in the country. Now they are down there about 43rd or 44th. And they rank 48th in the nation with regard to class size. We have watched since the passage of Proposition 13 back in 1978, the steady erosion of financing for the public schools and a massive transfer of wealth from the public sector to some of the wealthiest corporate landowners in the state of California. The second big issue is that there has been a hemorrhaging of resources from the public schools by the corporate-backed for-profit education system and the network of charter schools that have developed throughout Los Angeles. And during the last school board election, corporate-backed candidates swept the majority now on the school board who support the continued privatization of public schools.
Well, this is the bigger picture, and I want to go back to that. But when you just read coverage, you hear, well, it's about class size. The union says they want class sizes to be smaller, which you noted. But then they say, well, the district says they just don't have the money for that. The money just doesn't exist to do that. That's kind of the granular issue that one sees in media coverage with then perhaps some allusion to this bigger picture question about visions. But if I could ask you, how are we to interpret the sort of day-to-day coverage that says, well, it's about the fact that the unions want funding that just doesn't exist?
California is the fifth largest economy in the world. The reality is that there is a $2 billion reserve within the LA Unified School District currently, and the superintendent that was hired by the charter-backed majority on the school board is a hedge fund multimillionaire who knows nothing about public education. So this is really a question of a fight for quality public education and a pushback against corporate-dominated policies, which are calling for the transference of wealth, the public sector, to the for-profit private education world, where there are no regulations, where corporations are making money off the education of our children.
Yeah, I think we have to have some question when folks are celebrated for not having a background in education, you know, as though public education is an area where you really want someone whose credential is being a disruptor. I would note what Leone Hamson wrote in the Washington Post, which was Arne Duncan, who recently had an op-ed against former Education Secretary Arne Duncan, who opposed the LA teacher strike. You know, his kids aren't in schools with classes the size of the classes in, you know, on average in Los Angeles. So a lot of these folks who are putting forward other or who are critical of public education, their kids are not in these schools. And it matters. You know, Aaliyah Wong wrote a piece in The Atlantic where she was interviewing striking workers, many of them Latino in Los Angeles. And they weren't even talking about Boitner, you know, or some of them weren't even talking about charters. They were really just talking about how they want something better for the kids that they teach.
Absolutely. And in Los Angeles, as in major cities throughout the country, there are major class and racial divides. 70% of the children in the public schools of Los Angeles are Latino, and there are large numbers of Asian and African-American students as well in the public schools. And increasingly, we see a situation where those with financial resources are choosing to put their children in private schools. So we have a public disinvestment policy with regard to public schools that is being led by corporate America, but that has certain support from those that have wealth and privilege in this country who can pay for other alternatives. So this is really a broader issue of civil and human rights. In the fifth largest economy in the world, it is a disgrace that our public schools are so poorly funded, and it has a disproportionate impact on low-income children and their families and students of color.
Right. And so coverage that sort of presents it as teachers versus students, I find just so invidious and so harmful when, you know, when you talk to these teachers, they're thinking of their students first.
Absolutely. The public support for the teachers of Los Angeles has been remarkable. The teachers have really emerged as heroes within this fight. They are challenging the status quo. They are fighting for a future for their children. These are teachers who are used to using their own money to pay for basic supplies and basic needs in the classroom. These are teachers who work many hours after the classroom in order to provide the support needed for their children. And they're putting up the good fight. And what's been very gratifying is to watch the broad public support that our teachers are enjoying right here in Los Angeles.
I spoke with labor reporter Mike Elk of Payday Report many months ago, talking about the teacher strike in West Virginia. And he was saying that we hear a lot about how unions are going under and, you know, they don't have any meaning in the society anymore, but that in the South, for example, you have unions that don't have collective bargaining rights. They're even in right-to-work states, and they're still winning victories. I've heard you also say that a drop-off in unionization, per se, doesn't necessarily mean that workers aren't organized. But what's happening in L.A. disputes that negativity in a number of ways, doesn't it?
Well, what is very dramatic is that the United Teachers of Los Angeles is affiliated with the largest union in the country, the National Education Association, as well as the American Federation of Teachers, one of the largest unions in the country. And the largest single group of organized workers in the country today are teachers. So the fact that we have such amazing solidarity among the teachers here in Los Angeles is a really powerful statement about the relevance and importance of unions in the fight not only for the rights of workers, but in the broader fight for quality public education.
And their ability to build partnerships with the community is what, when it comes that you have to go on a strike, that's how you can have a community supporting you in that action.
The fact that 500,000 children are impacted by this strike, and the fact that the parents and the community at large are standing with the teachers, is really a wake-up call in terms of what we need to do collectively to demand quality public education.
We've been speaking with Kent Wong, director of the UCLA Labor Center and currently vice president of the California Federation of Teachers. Kent Wong, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
Recent reporting by Politico, citing three administration sources, says that the Trump White House, having failed to get congressional support for the capping and shrinking of federal Medicaid spending, now plans to try to make those changes without congressional approval. Cutbacks to the low-income health program that helps some 75 million people, people with disabilities, children, seniors, they've long been a GOP goal. But every time it comes up, it's been soundly rebuffed by a range of advocates for people who rely on the program. Clearly, that vigilance is still required, and our next guest has been tracking the issue. Rebecca Vallis is the vice president of the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress and the host of the podcast Off Kilter. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Rebecca Vallis.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Well, this is a disturbing new tactic, trying to ram through the dismantling of Medicaid by some sort of executive action. But proponents of that dismantling, which now include Seema Verma, administrator of what's called the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Service, their argument, or the one they say out loud anyway, seems basically unchanged. So maybe we should start with addressing the idea that folks will have seen in media coverage, that capping federal Medicaid spending, converting it to block grants, would give states more flexibility in how they administer the program.
So, Janine, I'm really appreciative that you started there, because I feel like block grant is one of those jargon terms that gets thrown around in the halls of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., but it needs to be decoded a little bit for folks to really take it and understand what it means in English. So block grant is code for converting a program from one that guarantees coverage to everyone who qualifies, that is currently the way that Medicaid works, to a program that helps fewer and fewer eligible people over time, because it involves capping that program's funding in a way that declines year after year. So currently, Medicaid is it's a federal state program. That means it's partially funded by the feds. It's partially funded by the states. The feds pick up a set percentage of states' Medicaid costs. And what a block grant would do to the Medicaid program is to cap the amount of federal funds that states get, giving them a fixed dollar amount, and then requiring them to pick up the rest. So effectively, block granting is a backdoor strategy for making really, really deep cuts to a program, and in this case, Medicaid, in a way that's intentionally designed to make those cuts grow deeper every single year. And your listeners will not be surprised to hear that what that means in the case of Medicaid is lots and lots of people losing their health insurance.
And there's research on this. This is not speculation. We know what block grants actually turn out to mean when they're put into place.
That's exactly right. And this is definitely not a new idea, as you said. I mean, it goes all the way back to former Speaker Paul Ryan's Kegger days. He told us that one of his dreams in Congress was to dismantle Medicaid by block granting it. But analysis of a recent proposal similar to this that House Republicans had included as part of the recent health care fight, where they were trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but also trying to dismantle Medicaid. That was a big part of that fight, too. Analysis of a proposal that Republicans had put forth to block grant Medicaid, and this comes to us from the Urban Institute, it estimated that between 14 million and 21 million Americans would have lost Medicaid if that proposal had taken effect. So that is the kind of policy that we're watching this White House continue to try to champion, despite the fact that the American people stood up and loudly rejected the White House's and Republicans in Congress's attempt to take health insurance away from tens of millions of Americans, including through their attempts that failed to dismantle Medicaid through legislation. And part of the reason I'm connecting the current proposal from this administration to the healthcare fight of 2017 and to some extent 2018 is because this is exactly the kind of playbook we have seen this White House take to. When Trump doesn't get his cruel agenda through Congress, he turns around and takes matters into his own hands and tries to see how much damage he can do to programs that help low-income folks like Medicaid by fiat. So that's what he's doing here. He's trying to sidestep Congress and take health insurance away from potentially tens of millions of Americans unilaterally.
I interviewed ADAPT organizer, disability rights organizer Mike Irvin in 2011 when 91 protesters, many of them in wheelchairs, had been arrested on Capitol Hill protesting another assault on Medicaid, Paul Ryan, as you're referring to. And Mike Irvin's response to the idea that block grants give states flexibility was to say, that's like saying Jim Crow laws give states more flexibility to decide who gets to drink at their water fountains. You know, flexibility is basically a code word for abandonment. And people with disabilities would be especially hard hit or impacted by these sorts of changes, wouldn't they?
That's exactly right. People with disabilities are really one of the groups who would be hurt the most if Medicaid were dismantled by a block grant proposal like this. And that's because for many people with disabilities and folks with severe health conditions, Medicaid isn't just health insurance. It's also home and community-based services. I'm talking here about personal attendant care, skilled nursing, the kind of stuff that makes it possible for millions of people with disabilities to live independently, to remain in their homes instead of being forced into institutions to receive the kinds of care and services that they need. So loss of Medicaid would push people with disabilities potentially into institutions in droves, but it would also, and this is sort of a secondary point that doesn't get a lot of attention in the healthcare context, loss of Medicaid would also push lots of people with disabilities out of the workforce. And that's because those home and community-based services I was just talking about don't just enable people with disabilities to live independently in many cases, but also to work outside the home. And that's really what's at stake here for folks with disabilities, not just loss of needed care that allows them to remain healthy, but also independence at its core.
That was one of the points that you made in a very well-received and useful Twitter thread. And I thought it really struck me because it just adds additional weirdness to the fact that people continue to trot out this line that public assistance is about lulling people into laziness and so on. And we're really talking about a change that would have the effect of making it impossible for some people to work in the way that they have been doing.
And that's not just true for people with disabilities and severe health conditions. We've also seen now a growing body of research telling us that Medicaid expansion is actually a huge pro-work strategy, because when people are healthier, maybe this doesn't come as quite a shock to your listeners, but when people are healthier, they're better able to work. They have higher earnings. They have higher labor force participation. So this administration has really been doing everything it can to try to dress up its cruel cut agenda with puppies and rainbows language that makes it sound like it's all in service of work. But this is actually a massively counterproductive strategy if the goal is actually work, and we know it's not.
You also note in that thread that it isn't only people who lose insurance who can be harmed, because states that are pushed to cut costs will find other ways to do that, like throwing up hoops or making it harder to get medicines and services. But for those who could and would lose insurance, that means we should really think about harms up to and including death, including people dying, right?
Now, Republicans in Congress really don't like when people make the point that you just made about how when you take health care away from people, people die and lives are literally on the line. But that's not histrionic. That's reality, unfortunately, here. And as a result, back during the health care fight in 2017, some folks took to calling Medicaid cuts like block grants the real death panels. I'm going to put some numbers to this for anyone who thinks that that's overblown or histrionic, like some of the proponents of these cuts have claimed that they are. The Congressional Budget Office back in 2017, taking a look at some of those Republican health care repeal plans, they estimated that more than 200,000 so-called unnecessary deaths, literally people dying who otherwise would not have, would occur by 2026 if the Senate Republican health care repeal plan had taken health insurance away from tens of millions of Americans, as it would have. So that's what's at stake here, is literally people's lives that are on the line if this kind of a policy takes effect. But on the flip side of the coin, we know that expanding Medicaid actually saves lives. And some analysis from the Center for American Progress finds that if all of the states, the 14 states that still are refusing to adopt Medicaid expansion, did expand the program, we would save over 100,000 lives just over the coming decade. So we know what to do from a policy perspective if what we're trying to do is to make sure we have a healthy population and workforce. But this agenda that is still being pursued by the Trump administration to take health insurance away from as many people as possible, even without the blessing of Congress, now that they've failed to get it, it literally is an agenda that will kill people.
Well, let me just say finally, as you've noted, the people have spoken on this, you know, repeatedly. They want no part of it. They prefer Medicaid to expand rather than shrink. You know, I mean, go figure. You know, folks just aren't in favor of cutting the safety net. But what about the politics? Bob Casey, the Democratic senator, has said hell no to this whole idea of, you know, changing Medicaid by fiat. I see Representative Frank Pallone from Jersey says that CMS doesn't have the legal authority to block grant Medicaid. What's your sense of what the administration has the power to do here and what can we do?
You are exactly right that legal advocates wasted no time in taking a look at this and voicing their very strong read that Trump does not have the legal authority to block grant Medicaid through administrative action. This is something that would take an act of Congress. So lawsuits are inevitably going to follow if the administration does move forward with this plan. And at the same time, the newly Democratic-controlled House will for sure try to block this cruel move. House Democrats have already vowed to investigate the Trump administration's healthcare sabotage. This is part and parcel of that ongoing sabotage effort. And as you said, Senate Democrats as well, even though they're not in control of that chamber, will be important voices in this debate as well. But I want to just leave people with the note that even though we're still waiting to see where things go from here, what exactly the proposal looks like out of this administration, it wouldn't hurt to call your member of Congress and let them know what you think, especially now that House Democrats are poised to be a check on Trump. And we know where the American people stand on this. Polling by the Center for American Progress last year found that 80% of Americans oppose cutting Medicaid. The American people loudly and clearly said no when Republicans in Congress and the Trump administration tried to dismantle this popular program as part of their health care repeal efforts. And that is exactly why we're seeing the Trump administration try to go around Congress and do this unilaterally, because they know it's not something that the American people would allow to happen if it were done in the light of day.
We've been speaking with Rebecca Vallis, Vice President of the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress, host of the podcast Off Kilter. She's on Twitter at Rebecca Vallis. Rebecca Vallis, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.